Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's official. Swine flu is a pandemic. Today, the World Health Organization raised its alert level to 6, meaning the flu is spreading globally since it emerged in Mexico and the U.S. in April at a sustained rate on a scale measured by the WHO. But what else does the alert mean? Dr. Robert Webster is a flu expert at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. Dr. Webster, the official announcement, we understand, is, first of all, supposed to trigger mechanisms. What are they?
Well, it triggers a mechanism to speed up production of vaccines, release antiviral viral drugs, and make these things as available as possible in this situation.
It's also supposed to prompt governments to devote more money to containing the virus. But you say we've been doing many of these things all along.
I would say we've got all of these things in hand.
Yeah.
We've been preparing for this for several weeks now, and all of these things are in hand, and in a sense, very little has changed.
Well, we just want to know one thing, because it sounds so scary. Does raising the level 2 pandemic mean that swine flu is getting more deadly?
There is no evidence at all that this virus is getting more deadly. It is similar to seasonal flu, and people should, at this time, think about as seasonal flu.
Well, more on,
it is no more serious.
Well, more on, though, the seriousness in a moment. But we understand that we were in level 5. That means a global outbreak is imminent. Now we're at 6, the pandemic. And that means that the flu virus, by definition from the WHO, is spreading in at least 2 world regions. But we know you're one of the flu watchers who feels that we've been doing that, that today's announcement is overdue. Why? What happened?
I think the World Health Organization have been very responsible. They don't want the world population to panic and have incidents to occur as have occurred in Argentina, where buses are stoned. There is no reason for this.
Well, let's explain. A bus arriving in Argentina from Chile was stoned by people who thought a passenger on it had swine flu. Chile has the most swine flu cases in South America. But we know that some flu watchers are saying that the WHO should have gone to the alert sooner, but there were political reasons, that there were some countries who were afraid of just that kind of panic.
I think it's that's the case. You know, there is a feeling that with the word pandemic, that the sky is going to fall. It is not going to fall. And so the World Health Organization had to judge the time to make the announcement. We can officially use the word pandemic now.
Well, we understand that when the WHO was meeting about this all week in emergency meetings, when they saw the flu start spreading rapidly in Australia recently, they decided they had no choice but to put it up to 6, even though there might be some nations, you know, overwhelmed by people, you know, rushing, flooding hospitals and such. But let's get back to the severity. The WHO reporting about 29,000 cases worldwide, only 140 deaths, although each one tragic. But we're reminded the Hong Kong flu in 1968, killed about 1 million people. So remind us, why should we be concerned?
We have to be concerned that this H1N1 virus is related to the virus that occurred in 1918. And when we look back at our historical records, that virus was mild in the springtime and came back in the fall as this very severe virus. And so that is one possibility that we worry about. The other thing that we worry about is that there is another virus out there, so-called H5N1 bird flu, and the current virus has a tendency to reassort and pick up genes from other viruses. And we worry that this bird flu, which doesn't transmit to humans at all well, may pick up the transmissibility from the H1N1 virus. And that is one of our worries.
Combine and mutate. Well, given that, we have just about a minute left. And you're a frequent visitor to the program, so we'll have you back again. But what do you think about purposely catching the flu because it might come back more severe? There's talk about swine flu parties, people trying to get it now to build up an immunity in case it comes back stronger in the fall. It sounds a little like Russian roulette. What do you should people do that?
Well, you can't. I don't think it's a wise situation to expose yourself to any infectious disease because you don't know the consequence of doing so. There is arguments for doing this. I personally wouldn't recommend it. But if you look back at 1918 and the mild wave, you can make a case for doing it. Personally, I wouldn't do it. But you can make a logical reason for doing so.
Well, one of the reasons maybe not to is that some of the deaths have been young people who may not have known that they had other medical issues going on and succumbed to the flu. Dr. Robert Webster, flu expert at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, as the WHO raises the swine flu alert to pandemic level. Thank you so much, Dr. Webster, as always.
You're welcome.
So the swine flu alert has been raised. And separately, have you noticed interest rates have shot up? These are the rates that lenders charge for things like your mortgage. Why are they going up? Well, it could have something to do with the huge government debt with the Obama administration investing in everything from car companies to banks. It could also have something to do with the way the Federal Reserve has been trying to keep interest rates low so that we'll all go out and buy things. Okay, everyone remain calm. We are going to try to pick our way through the often thorny patch of debt and interest rates. But lucky for us, our guide is Greg Ipp, U.S. economics editor for The Economist magazine. And so, Greg, let's get going. First of all, very simple. Have I got that right? Interest rates, the money lenders charge to borrow?
That's correct. Now, let's go back to last year. The Federal Reserve was facing a situation where the economy was extremely weak, entering recession. And so they did what they always do. They lower their short-term interest rate target. Now, by short-term, I mean this interest rate only affects loans that are taken out for a few days or a few months. So, for example, it might affect the rate that a company pays on a line of credit from its bank, or might affect your home equity line of credit if it's linked to the prime rate. But it would not necessarily affect a long-term interest rate, such as on a mortgage. Well, this worked fine until around December, because by that point, the Fed was working so hard to get the economy going, it had lowered its short-term interest rate target all the way to zero.
Short-term rates also are applied to the money that banks borrow from the Federal Reserve?
Exactly. In fact, the rate that the Fed sets is, in fact, the rate that banks pay when they borrow from the Fed or from each other.
So they're almost at zero. They have nowhere to go.
There is no way the Fed has using its conventional tools to make money borrowing conditions any easier.
So tell us what else the Fed has been doing.
So the Fed said, well, we might be out of traditional bullets, but we still have bayonets and other types of weapons at handy. So they said, why stop with just short-term interest rates? Why don't we try and find a way to get down long-term interest rates as well? And so some months ago, they entered the market and they began buying hundreds of billions of dollars of bonds, the bonds that are issued by the Treasury Department to finance the government, bonds that are issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are the two big mortgage agencies that guarantee millions of homeowners' mortgages, and then bonds that are essentially backed by thousands and thousands of mortgages themselves. And the point of this was that because the Fed was willing to essentially buy those bonds, that essentially made it possible for the government or anybody else to sell the bonds at a lower interest rate than they otherwise would.
But the Federal Reserve, we understand, spent, what, $1.75 trillion?
Exactly. They figured that in order to make a big difference, they had to buy a lot because this is a very large market in the tens of trillions of dollars. And it is a global market where it is not just American investors who buy and sell, but foreign investors as well. So in order to make an impact, the Federal Reserve felt that they had to act with a sizable initiative.
Where are they getting that money?
Well, the Federal Reserve is a central bank, and what sets a central bank apart from a regular bank is that when they buy a bond, they don't have to find the money somewhere. They just print it, and that's exactly what they did. They simply printed the money.
Well, so there's a lot of money flying around out there, and initially it had the good effect, right? We saw long-term interest rates go down.
That's exactly what happened. Long-term interest rates went down a lot. Mortgage interest rates dropped a lot. People who weren't able to refinance before could now refinance their mortgages.
And why is it going up now?
Well, for a couple of reasons, and people have different opinions about this. Certainly, one of the reasons long-term interest rates started to go up was that oddly enough, the economy began to look better and people became less scared. And so as people began to feel better about the economy, they took their money out of bonds, which caused their prices to go down and their interest rates to go up, and they put it in other things. And that's one of the reasons we saw the stock market go up. So one of the rules on Wall Street is that bond markets love bad news. Well, they also hate good news, and we've had a lot of good news relative to what we'd had before. And so bond interest rates started to go up. So that's good as far as it goes. Nobody was too worried at first that bond interest rates were going up because it was initially a sign that people were feeling better about things and they had a bit more appetite for risk. But then a couple of other things began to creep in. First of all, people began to realize that the Obama administration plans to borrow a huge hunk of money this year on the order of $1.8 trillion, and it's going to continue. Even though the deficits will drop, they'll still be on the order of $1 trillion 3 or 4 years from now. That's a huge amount of money to borrow, and in order for the government to borrow all that money, they may have to offer extremely attractive interest rates. That's definitely one of the factors that's been pushing up long-term interest rates. And then the final factor is people began to look at the actions that the Federal Reserve took, and they said, well, hold on a minute. These aggressive operations to essentially print money to get the economy going, that's as good as far as it goes, and maybe the economy does need that. But what about the long term? Eventually, if all that money you've printed gets out in the economy and gets spent, won't that cause inflation? And if there's an inflation, shouldn't I ask for a high interest rate on my bonds? And so that's one of the other factors that appears to be pushing long-term interest rates up now.
Okay, Greg, I got to stop you there because this is where I refer to my yellowing little cutout from USA Today. It's called Inflation 101. It explains inflation. As you said, people, businesses start to spend money on things. The demand outpaces supply. Businesses raise their prices on the things they're selling, and the demand continues to rise. And then the price gets so high that people stop spending, and then suddenly you have more products than people to buy them.
That's right. Essentially, inflation happens when you have too much demand for goods and services and not enough supply. And so that's the big debate going on right now. The view of Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, is that there is not a lot of demand out there right now. The unemployment rate is almost 10%, a doubling from a few years ago. That means a lot of workers out there who do not have the means to spend and who would be quite happy to take a job earning less than the person who has the job already. So that will put downward pressure on wages. You have a lot of companies with idle factories. They'd be quite happy to sell more products even if it meant lowering the price. In a situation like that, it's very hard to imagine getting very much inflation. And so the view of the Federal Reserve is that these efforts that we're taking to restart the economy are years away from creating the excess of demand and spending that would cause an inflation. But they kind of have to convince the markets that's true. The markets are saying, well, sure, right now there isn't much inflation, but what about 2 or 3 years from now? You've printed all this money. Do you think you can unprint the money fast enough to prevent inflation? That's the big question.
Actually, you say the biggest question of all is, what is endgame? You know, how does the Fed get out of the business of keeping interest rates low? Okay, well, we all need a breather. Greg Ipp is with The Economist. We're going to have more of our economics lesson with him after a break. Later today, GM's new humbled ad campaign. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. Our guest is Greg Ipp. He's U.S. economics editor for The Economist. He's been walking us through the relationship between interest rates and government debt. And Greg, before the break, we were talking about the steps being taken by the Federal Reserve to artificially keep interest rates low and stimulate buying. They're spending billions of dollars on things like bonds to encourage others to buy. And the Fed defends printing all the money to get into this debt by saying that we aren't really going to see the impact for years. But I'm just wondering, aren't we seeing some of it already?
Yes, in fact, there have been some encouraging signs. It doesn't just reflect the activity the Fed has been doing the last 2 or 3 months, but the activity of the last 6 months of lowering short-term interest rates last year, the federal government's fiscal stimulus, the aggressive efforts to stabilize our banks so that they can continue to lend. And we have seen some positive signs. For example, we learned this morning on Thursday that retail sales grew in the month of May. and the stock market is up about 30% from its bottom. So there are signs that the economy is pulling out of its slump and that the recession may end soon.
Well, but you worry about the downside of the Federal Reserve's plan to, again, keep interest rates low by buying up things like bonds, because it may help people buy things. But on the other end of the equation, you have investors, and low interest rates, as you've said, aren't necessarily good for them. The economist Peter Morici raises a fairness question here. He says when the Federal Reserve keeps interest rates low, it also lowers the interest rates on money in the bank. And since it's disproportionately the elderly who rely on their interest income, this policy is making grandma give up part of her income.
Yes, it is true that when you change the price of something, you create winners and losers. And essentially, the interest rate is the price of money. And so when the Fed artificially pushes down the price of money, those who have money to lend, like somebody who has money in certificates of deposit, they end up a loser. But that's just the cold, hard reality of how this works, because what would the alternative be? For the Fed to raise interest rates and therefore reward the savers better? I think it's obvious that that would end up tanking demand for houses and cars and putting the economy into a deeper recession. So essentially, a few savers now do have to suffer in order for the greater good of the economy to prevail.
Well, so you're not necessarily saying that the Federal Reserve's plan is a bad thing, but what you are saying is that the Federal Reserve has no exit plan. In fact, you've compared the Federal Reserve to a firefighter.
Yes. Essentially, a firefighter doesn't want to enter a burning building unless he's quite sure he knows how he can get out when he's done. In the old days, the exit strategy was simple. Once the Fed had lowered interest rates and got the economy going, they raised them again. Well, they can still raise interest rates, but what about this other stuff? They now will own several $1 trillion worth of bonds. Those are awfully difficult to sell. The day they tell the world, hey, we're going to sell our $2 trillion in bonds, you would have chaos in the markets. So they have to find some other, less disruptive way of shrinking their balance sheet and basically unprinting all the money that they've printed. And they're casting around for different tools for doing that. Now, they think they have the ability to get interest rates up even though they have all that extra money sloshing around in the system. But the fact of the matter is they're in uncharted territory now, and the Fed continues to study this and put out feelers to the Treasury and Congress saying, perhaps you could give us a few extra tools to help us out of this recession. And right now, Congress isn't really in the mood to give the Fed anything. In fact, a lot of people in the Congress think the Fed's too powerful, and they're making noises about doing things like, well, maybe the Congress should have the right to audit the Fed. Maybe we should trim the power of some of those Federal Reserve Bank presidents who keep talking about raising interest rates. Now, there's one final risk involved here. When the Federal Reserve tries to push down long-term interest rates, the way they do that is they go out and they buy Treasury bonds. The more people that there are willing to buy Treasury bonds, the lower the interest rate the government has to pay in order to sell all the bonds they need to finance their deficit. Sounds good? Well, sounds good up to a certain point. But, you know, it's actually kind of good to have the discipline of the market telling the government you can't just keep borrowing and borrowing and borrowing.
In effect, you say that the Federal Reserve buying all these federal government Treasury bonds is enabling the federal government to keep this huge deficit.
Absolutely. The federal government normally has to think about, well, how much money can we borrow before the world begins to question our ability to pay it back? And so when long-term interest rates go up, that's an important little signal to the government saying, hold on, you can't just borrow your way to prosperity. At some point, you have to convince us that you're willing to cut spending or raise taxes to pay for all the programs that you want to create. If the government instead has the comfort of knowing that the Federal Reserve is going to buy the bonds by essentially printing money, that relaxes that discipline. And then you begin to worry that they'll start to hem in the independence of the Fed, that the Fed's actions will be driven not by what is best for the economy, full employment and low inflation, but what's best for the government and the politicians in power and their desire to essentially spend lots of money without actually having to raise the taxes to pay for it. And that is one of the concerns out there, that the Federal Reserve, although they start with the best of intentions of trying to help out the economy, may end up basically becoming a handmaiden to a Treasury that is borrowing heavily and spending heavily.
Greg Ipp, you yourself say that it's sort of between a rock and a hard place, and just keep an eye on it. It's not as if people have solutions. It's sort of uncharted territory, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, essentially, the Federal Reserve's choices throughout this crisis have been bad and worse. And a lot of people at the Fed did worry a lot that if they were to enter the market and buy Treasury bonds, they would be seen as essentially printing money to help the government's budget deficits. But they basically made a choice that said the alternative to stand aside and let the economy get worse and worse and worse. That's not acceptable. So they simply said, we'll do this, and then we have to trust ourselves, and the market has to trust us, that when the day comes, we will assert the independence of the Federal Reserve and do what is necessary to withdraw this money, to sell those bonds, even if it causes a lot of pain and a lot of criticism from the Congress and the administration. That is just a chance they'll have to take.
And by the way, do you think Fed Chair Ben Bernanke will keep that chair?
I don't really know, but there's a lot of discussion on both sides of the debate. Most people think Mr. Bernanke has done an extremely laudable job of responding with creative ways and in a creative fashion to what has been the most extraordinary and difficult crisis in perhaps over 70 years in this country. On the other hand, he's a Republican, and we have a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress, and I don't doubt that they would like to see a Democrat in that position. So we'll just have to wait and see.
Greg Ibb, economics editor for The Economist magazine. Thank you so much for walking us through the world of interest rates. Thank you.
Good to talk to you, Robin.
And I think we all survived. Tomorrow on Here and Now, the story behind Carl Sandburg's guitar. We're listening to it right now. That's tomorrow. Back after the news, Here and Now. Much has been made of U.S. responsibility in Iraq and Afghanistan. When those wars end, it's said it's imperative that the U.S. leave behind a viable and safe environment. Well, as the BBC's Jill McGivering reports, U.S. policymakers might take a page from the not-too-distant past and consider the country of Laos, which borders Vietnam, and where people are still feeling the pain of U.S. bombings four decades ago.
Sok On is a small, remote village. It's a cluster of wooden stilt houses close to the border with Vietnam. I'm sitting with Mr. Da on his veranda, looking out at the mountains, which are covered with lush tropical rainforest and, at the moment, low morning mists. It's a still, peaceful scene, but Mr. Da has horrific injuries. 8 years ago, he was foraging for food in the forest nearby when a small bomb exploded. He lost both his arms and one of his eyes.
Life is very difficult for me now. I can't look after myself. My wife has to feed me and care for me and our children.
Laos was saturated with bombs during the Vietnam War. American planes were attacking North Vietnamese supply routes here and trying to stop the spread of communism. They made Laos per capita the most bombed country in history, dropping about 260 million small bombs. Mike Boddington is a technical advisor on victim assistance in Laos.
Who created this problem? It wasn't the Lao. The Americans came and dropped all of this stuff all over the country. America pays very, very little for clearing it up or looking after the victims. While the war was on, they were spending over $2 million a day, every day for 9 years, dropping these things on the countryside. Today, they're not spending much more than that, clearing it up every year.
The US is under pressure to do more, but so far it's refused to sign the new convention, which would ban cluster bombs and include a formal commitment to helping countries affected by them. Unexploded bombs are still being found here on a daily basis. Yesterday, some villagers were clearing this field and they reported one. So I've come along with a commercial demining company, Phoenix Clearance Limited, to have a look. So it looks the size of a small tennis ball and we can just see the top of it poking out above the soil. Do you know if it's active or not? Do you know if it might explode?
Oh, this is the perfect one. They have detonator inside also. It's still danger.
So you're going to try and blow it up in a controlled explosion?
Yep, that's right.
They're issuing a general warning first that if anyone's in the area foraging or trying to plant, they should get out of the way before the explosion.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
That one was exploded safely, but every year about 300 people are killed or injured by these hidden bomblets. This is the small hot workshop of the charity Cope in Vientiane, and I'm surrounded by people making artificial limbs. They turn out more than 1,000 a year, they tell me. And this is one of the few places where victims of cluster bombs can come and be treated for free. Joe Pereira is COPE's project coordinator.
There are services available for people, but often in remote areas people aren't aware. And so the poverty that they're already experiencing becomes even more acute because they're not able to contribute to productivity in the family. Medical bills can be very, very expensive. And then, of course, being isolated and not able to contribute to your community and society as a whole.
How would you assess the impact that these cluster munitions have had over the last 30 years on the ability of this country to develop?
It's definitely a factor in keeping Laos in its least developed status, and very difficult for people to be able to farm, to be able to get enough food just to live there is becoming increasingly difficult.
Laos is calling for help. The new International Convention on Cluster Bombs would commit signatories to paying for clearance and supporting victims. But so far, only 7 countries have ratified it.
That report from the BBC's Jill McGivering. We'll be back in 30 seconds, here and now.
Quick reminder, at the strike of 12 midnight tomorrow night, broadcast television stations will switch from analog to digital signals. The airwaves have been filled with PSAs heralding this change.
It might seem strange, but your antenna TV could become just a box if you don't get this box. Some TVs will stop working unless they're upgraded to digital television with this DTV converter box. Without this upgrade, your antenna TV will not work.
I can hear children saying, "What's an antenna TV?" Well, an antenna TV is the older analog set that uses an antenna or rabbit ears. It won't work. And as the ad said, if you have one of those, you'll have to buy a digital converter box or you will watch static. The government is offering coupons to help people pay for the digital converter box, but if you don't have the coupon yet, you won't be able to get it in time for the switch. If you already have a high-definition TV, you are set. Commerce Secretary Gary Locke also says people who have pay TV will not be affected.
If you currently have cable, satellite, or some other paid-for television service, you have nothing to worry about. You are prepared. You don't need to do anything. And June 12th, you'll see no change in your television reception or programming.
The Associated Press reports that about 2 million homes aren't ready to make the switch to digital, which means that they're going to lose all major broadcast channels, right? Oh, what about the time of The Tonight Show? Poor Conan. The switch marks the end of 6 decades of broadcasting analog TV signals, a method first demonstrated by Philo Farnsworth in 1928. Well, will digital TV make a new GM television ad campaign look sharper? GM is airing a new commercial that's part confessional, part pep rally. The one-minute spot paints GM as a phoenix rising from the ashes of bankruptcy, a better company.
Let's be completely honest. No company wants to go through this. But we're not witnessing the end of the American car. We're witnessing the rebirth of the American car. General Motors needs to start over in order to get stronger. There was a time when 8 different brands made sense. Not anymore. There was a time when our cost structure could compete worldwide. Not anymore. Reinvention is the only way we can fix this. And fix it, we will.
The reinvention campaign has won faint praise. Paul Fari of The Washington Post wrote, "Poor GM, once the mightiest company on the planet, now reduced to simpering and whimpering about reinvention. Ouch." Here now, media analyst and Boston University mass communication professor John Carroll joins us. What's your take on that commercial in particular?
Well, I don't think it's whimpering and simpering as much as sort of whistling past the graveyard. It's an ad that basically is standard issue kind of material. Unfortunately, it has this sort of jumble of images, most of which is video wallpaper. It's got all these factory-installed cliches that you have in these situations. It's not about going out of business. It's about getting down to business, all that kind of thing. I mean, it's something that I think GM needs to do, but I don't think they've done it all that well.
Well, but yeah, let's stay with the needs to do, because there are a lot of Americans who don't understand the word bankruptcy, and a lot of people think bankruptcy means like the carpet store down the street that's going out of business and leaving. And didn't GM
have to get across, we're not going away?
Absolutely. And these kinds of ads, ad campaigns, have multiple audiences. It's not just consumers that GM is talking to. They're talking to Wall Street. They're talking to their employees. They're talking to political leaders. There's a lot of constituencies out there that they need to reassure. And this is not the kind of ad. Chrysler, when it first got bailout money back in the spring, ran a bunch of full-page newspaper ads saying, "Thank you, America." That was a concept with a capital K. I mean, that was foolish because people said, why are you spending taxpayer dollars thanking taxpayers for giving you money that they didn't really want to give you in the first place?
Right.
And how many jobs could you have saved with that kind of with those kinds of revenues? What GM is saying now is basically, we're still in business. We have a sense of what we need to do, and stick with us because we're not going away. We're still 19% of the car market.
So you agree that they had to get that message out. You're not so sure about the vehicle. And you mentioned all these images, some of the shots, a man running around a track with a prosthetic leg, a very noble image, a workforce boarding a subway, images presumably meant to signal, you know, stick-to-iveness. But you know you're in trouble when you give John Stewart fodder. Now, he said of this ad, "Nothing says rebirth of a car company like shots of people taking a subway and a one-legged man who'd rather run." Then he went on to talk about President Obama's plan to invest another $30 billion in GM. Let's listen.
"We own GM! And it's only $30 billion for 60% of negative $90 billion. Why didn't you say that before? I'm so glad we bought.
It's not just the late-night comedians. It's front-page articles in the New York Times saying that GM's projections for the future are this sort of tailpipe dream that they're never going to achieve. It's also editorial cartoonists who are depicting President Obama as President Goodwrench. It's also Harvard Business School professors basically saying, you know, let GM crash and burn and let something new companies come out of the ashes of GM.
Well, they also have to deal with YouTube and spoofs of their ad. Let's listen.
"Let's be completely honest. Our lawyer says we have to. No company really wants to be responsible. And we're no different. But GM didn't kill the American car like we killed public transportation. Because let's face it, we stopped being a truly American car decades ago. Gracias, mi amigos."
And that last comment, "Gracias, mi amigos," comes with shots of workers in a Mexican factory referring to GM outsourcing its work overseas. So, John, you know, be advisor here. That is a pretty dead-on spoof of the GM ad, the sound and everything. What should GM have done?
Well, GM is, they're doing a couple of other things, too. I mean, they're on YouTube trying to fight fire with fire. They're on Facebook. They have blogs. They have Twitter. It's just that they can't get the critical weight. The Twitter blog that they have has 7,000 followers. Ashton Kutcher has a million followers. Yeah. So, I mean, they're not going to be able to overcome this. All they can do is hope to be in the arena and do the best they can.
Well, and boy, have times changed. Because there was a time when General Motors, all it had to do was put out the iconic TV ad, and it had a sort of white light around it. You know, let's listen to a montage of some of the GM ads, starting in 1952 with Dinah Shore in a ball gown singing "See the USA in Your Chevrolet."
"See the USA in your Chevrolet. America's asking you to call. Drive your Chevrolet through the USA.
The heartbeat of America.
America is still the land of rugged individualists.
This is our country.
This is our country.
This is our truck. The all-new Chevy Silverado."
So going backwards, John Mellencamp with "This Is Our Country," 2006, that's the GM Revolution campaign. Before that, Bob Seger's "Like a Rock," the theme for Chevy trucks. 1987, "The Heartbeat of America," and in 52, Dinah Shore with "See the USA in Your Chevrolet." Could they come up with that ad, get Bruce Springsteen to sing something? Could they do it again?
They can get Bruce Springsteen if they can afford him. I mean, they should put out a CD. That would be a great little driving CD. Yeah,
right.
I think that times have changed in the advertising business significantly. There was a time when you created your brand yourself. Now branding is a collaboration with customers, with critics, industry analysts. I mean, there is this sort of conversation that goes on. And so what they have to do is get out there and have the right kind of conversation. But they have no choice but to go out and deliver this message. The problem is, this is about the 10th time they're delivering the same message. This time, though, it's on the taxpayer's dime. So they're under a lot more criticism, a lot more pressure.
To get it right. Here now, media analyst, Boston University mass communication professor John Carroll, talking about GM's attempt to control its message after declaring bankruptcy. John, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, we'll be back in a minute with another look back at the flu pandemic of 1918, here and now. Our top story today, the World Health Organization classified the latest outbreak of H1N1 virus, also known as swine flu, a pandemic. The WHO reports that worldwide there have been nearly 29,000 cases, about 140 deaths, and they warn a second, more severe wave may be coming. Well, that's what happened in the Spanish flu pandemic in 1918, which ultimately killed as many as 50 million people around the world. The 1918 flu struck in the middle of World War I, in fact, was probably carried home to the U.S. by unsuspecting soldiers. Given today's news, not to scare anyone, but to alert you to a great read, we want to revisit our conversation about the 1918 flu, a story poignantly told in the novel Wicket's Remedy. Author Myla Goldberg, whose debut novel was the best-selling Bee Season, paints vivid pictures of devastation.
People covered every available space, some sitting, others lying on the floor or propped up against the wall. Open windows and camphor failed to mask the stink of sickness, a moist, mucosal smell that hung, dank and bitter, over everything. Lydia realized with a shock that she was surrounded by people her age, the usual victims of Southey's flus and fevers, the very young and the very old, were absent. In their place were young men and women in numbers one would expect to see at a dance, only in place of movement. There was stillness.
That's Myla Goldberg reading from Wicket's Remedy. Lydia is Lydia Kelleny, a young woman raised in the working-class neighborhood of South Boston in the early 1900s. She works as an uptown shop girl to break from her blue-collar roots. And there she meets her future husband, medical student Henry Wicket, and then both their lives become subsumed by the flu. Author Myla Goldberg spent 5 years researching and writing Wicket's Remedy. We spoke to her in 2005 when it was avian flu that was on everyone's mind, and we asked Myla, was the flu on her mind when she decided to write about this chapter in history?
Well, it never had been on my mind before. In fact, I've never had a flu shot. I've never particularly believed in them. But I'd finished my first book and knew I was ready to start into something new. And I'd been reading the New York Times, and there was an article that listed the 5 worst epidemics of all time. And the 1918 influenza epidemic was listed among them. And as you mentioned, this was 5 years ago. You know, the flu was not on the front page every day. And I had never heard of it. And I thought to myself, well, gosh, you know, if it was such a terrible thing, how come I haven't? And so that kind of drove me into wanting to research it, and wanting to write this book kind of stemmed from both my fascination and horror with that time period and also just my curiosity as to how something that big can be forgotten.
You pull us back into that time. I mean, you will not forget it ever having read the book. Tell me some of the things you discovered about this flu that, you know, compelled you to keep writing.
Just the degree to which it basically shut society down. That's something you associate with the Middle Ages. You know, you think of the bubonic plague and, like, you know, the guy going, bring out your dead and the wagons. And, like, you don't think that's supposed to happen in the 20th century. And it did. I mean, literally, in Philadelphia and in Boston, you had, in the mornings, wagons going down the streets asking for people to bring their dead to the doors. And the more I read and the more I realized, you know, nothing changes. We like to think we put certain bits of history behind us and move forward, but we don't. You know, this stuff keeps happening over and over again.
Well, in fact, you've worked in newspaper clippings from the time. Are those real newspaper clippings?
Yeah, I mean, that's the other shocking thing. I mean, I did a bunch of research for this thing. I mean, I didn't know dookie about 1918 or the flu or anything. So the first 6 months of this project, all I was doing was reading.
Do I understand that you would only read books from before 1945?
Yeah, for the first 3 years of this 5-year process, I was only reading books written before then, and that was tough for someone who's, you know, as inveterate a reader as myself and as compulsive a reader. You know, all these new things were coming up, but I knew I had to avoid them because I wanted to get inside the head of the times, and I knew that I couldn't be paying attention to this other stuff, both for that reason and also because whatever I read tends to influence how I write, and I wanted it to feel timeless. You know, I didn't want it to feel like late 20th or early 21st century.
Oh, so. It really does. The language and the way they speak, and especially, you know, for people in Boston, it will resonate. But to these newspaper clippings that you put in, one, for instance, tells of a new city ordinance. All places of amusement will be closed. Sunday schools, churches discontinued. Public, private, and kindergarten schools mm-hmm. closed at the height of the flu. This is all true.
All of this is true. Basically, every single newspaper article in there, except for two that are really boring and aren't sensation at all that I had to include just for, like, purposes of plot, they're all from actual period newspapers. And there's some really outrageous ones in there. Like, you've got a woman who stops growing a particular flower because mm-hmm. she hears that the Kaiser of Germany likes it, and it's just really strange.
It's really amazing how you managed to capture, through this character Lydia, everything that was happening, because we remember that this horrific war was also being mm-hmm. fought, and her husband, who was going to be a doctor, drops out of medical school to create Wicket's Remedy. It's a delightful tonic that comes with a letter from him encouraging you to feel better.
Right.
Was there ever such a tonic?
I made it up. I mean, it seems to me that most tonics were bunkum. And so the idea that someone embracing the idea that a tonic is bunk and trying to cure people through alternate means just really appealed to me.
Well, as we said, their lives just become, subsumed by flu. She eventually goes off to an island off the coast of Boston to work in a medical program that really was sort of experimenting on prisoners to see if they could find out how this flu was transferred. Did that really happen?
Yeah, it did. I mean, basically every single major event that occurs in this book is taken straight from history. And as you mentioned, the last third of this book concerns experiments that were done on human volunteers who said, yes, yes, I want to be a part of this. They were trying to test flu transmission on human subjects. So these guys, they were naval prisoners, and a lot of these guys were in prison not because they were against the war, but because military justice was even more arbitrary back then than it is now, and they had done very little to deserve being in there, and they did want to be fighting, and this was the only chance they had to show that they too were patriots.
Well, Myla Goldberg, in the book, we should mention, you also write these sort of brief comments in the margins of the book. It's sort of a Greek chorus, another layer of commentary. It appears to be the souls of people mm-hmm. who were there at the time commenting. Why are they there?
This book was very much about exploring memory and its unreliability and its frailty, both on individual and a collective level. And I liked the idea of having voices chiming in as you're reading a story saying, hey, you know what? It didn't come out that way actually at all. It was this other way. Because when you're reading a book, you tend to just assume that the voice you're hearing is the gold standard and what they're saying is actually true. But nothing can be relied upon. Memory is just such a feeble, feeble thing. And so the idea of having these voices chime in to kind of give their opinions, I think, is a neat way to kind of have the reader experience that.
Well, you leave the reader with this sense of just, you know, millions of souls taken by this flu and by that war. Myla, I want to ask you, I'm at a passage on page 160, which mm-hmm. really describes how horrific this illness is. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I'm wondering if you could read a little of that.
Sure. Influenza loosed pneumonia into the lungs, and pneumonia's sounds were those of a body drowning from within. Pneumonia turned skin and lips the bruised gray-blue of an evening sky before a storm. She was informed in hushed voices by the nurses that those whose feet were tinged that color seldom lived through the night.